65,498 square miles. We've got a lot to cover, so let's get to it. This is Spanning the State, and here are your hosts, Kristen Bry and Brian Noonan.
Good afternoon. Well, you can say what you want, Brian.
I can.
But the man has stamina.
Yeah,
President Trump, 100 minutes. It was a record-breaking 100 minutes speech last night, which broke his RNC speech, which was 92 minutes. And I don't know. I don't know if I have that kind of stamina.
Well, when you're, you know, when you're not bogged down by facts, it's easy to just keep talking. And, you know, Adrian Brody did a long speech, too, and we all hated that as well.
That's true.
You know.
A little different.
Length
doesn't... 5 minutes and 40 seconds and 100 minutes.
Yeah, but if you took out all the greatest hits, the amount of time may be the same for both speeches.
Fair enough. Fair enough. But yes, in his first major speech to Congress of his second term, President Donald Trump made clear that he intends to barrel forward with the MAGA agenda. And so it was largely, for me, reminiscent of a campaign-style speech. But I also don't know if that's just kind of what they've become now.
It's the same thing over and over again. It's just a different location, the same message. You know, there was a lot of extraneous stuff going on in the room. There was a lot of, you know, we're not going to spout out a lot of facts and try to fact check because facts don't matter. We know that. This is very performative. This was the president talking to his side of the room and his supporters out who were viewing this. It was, you know, all pretense of working together is out the window. So it's like, all right, well, this is it. And then we know, okay, we're going to have a Democrat come on and they're going to say pretty much the opposite of what we just watched for an hour and a half. So it's a little boring at this point. I mean, I watch and I pay attention because I'm an American and I
well, here's the question. If you didn't have to come to work today and talk about it, would you have watched?
Probably
or would you just
not.
read the coverage the next day?
I would have done it today if I didn't have to deal with it.
Because that is the thing now, it feels like whether it's the debates, whether it's a big speech like this, there's so many different media routes that you're like, well, if it's funny enough, if it's important enough,
right.
If it's dramatic enough, it's going to get clipped into a million different ways that I've been able to consume it across a ton of different social media platforms.
And at that time of night, I want to end the night on an up note. I can start my day with, you know, heavy stuff, but I don't want to end my night with heavy stuff. I want to end my night just relaxing and then going to sleep. And then I'll wake up to whatever fresh hell is unleashed on us the next day.
Well, my favorite part was the transgender mice, which I think he was trying to say transgenic mice, which is mice that have had DNA. They're genetically modified.
Sure.
Mice. That's what he was trying to say.
Okay.
But that is the memes that came out of that one, I think, were my my lighthearted favorite.
I unfortunately didn't have much lightheartedness. I just was trying to figure out after I watched it if free speech was actually back. Or if it was back only unless you were a news outlet that didn't agree with the administration or somebody who was going to protest on a college campus. I was like, all right, is it back? Where? And, you know, I did go out and have a drink to celebrate the fact that wokeness is dead. That I learned last night, too.
DEI is DOA.
Yeah.
all right. Well, we are going to end this hour with a bigger conversation around decorum and what the State of the Union or joint resolutions, congressional talks are like now. But one thing that was not mentioned last night, but was mentioned on Sunday, is a new crypto reserve. So when we come back, we're going to figure out what would that look like, who benefits, with our friend and our crypto expert, David Krause. So stay with us on Spanning the State. Domo arigato, Mr. Roboto, domo. Domo. Domo arigato, Mr. Roboto, domo.
Wow, Mr. Roboto, crypto, it's all getting covered here on Spanning the State. I'm Brian Noonan.
And I'm Kristen Bry. And on Sunday, President Donald Trump named five digital assets, Bitcoin, Ether, XRP, Solana, and Cardano, that will make up a, quote, crypto strategic reserve for the United States. This follows the January 23rd executive order establishing the Working Group on Digital Asset Markets. So what does this look like? What does it mean? Who's going to pay for it? How are we paying for it? Who benefits? Who better to ask?
A lot of questions.
All those questions. Who's going to answer them? David Krause, Emeritus Associate Professor of Finance at Marquette University. This is your third time joining us to explain crypto to us.
That's right. And it'll only take about 100 more till we understand.
Yes, exactly. So I guess let's start. My bigger question is what a crypto reserve is, but should we first just explain what a reserve is?
Well, we have a strategic reserve.
Yes.
We have oil and we have gold in the U.S. strategic reserve. And some of it makes sense from a utility standpoint. Keeping oil is important for national defense, and gold was the basis behind our currencies for many years.
Yeah.
So it's not uncommon for strategic assets to be in reserve.
So then what does this mean to have a crypto reserve?
Well, nothing says strategic like crypto, huh?
Depends on who you ask.
Don't you have to have something concrete to reserve it?
One would think.
Okay.
Now, you know, other countries have sovereign wealth funds. We run deficits. Other countries run surpluses.
Okay.
And you know, just like the state of Wisconsin, when I was here several months ago, invest money long term.
Yeah, like stocks, pension. Bonds, yeah, right. The pensions, yeah.
You know, if we as a country were running surpluses, then maybe the idea of putting crypto into a sovereign wealth fund as a way to diversify long term holdings might make sense. I mean, other countries are doing that. But we're running a $37 trillion deficit, and the idea of taking taxpayer money and putting it in crypto as a reserve, it's questionable.
So, and is that the only way we basically could pay for it, right?
Yes. I mean, first of all, there's, I think, $17 billion worth of crypto that's been seized over the years. You might remember Silk Road.
Right, yeah.
And there were several other hacks and instances where we were able to claw back some of the crypto that had been stolen. So we already, as a government, own about $17 billion worth of crypto.
Okay.
Now, you know, some countries, when they claw back money, Germany has done this as well. And they took the Silk Road Bitcoin money and immediately liquidated it and put it into the general fund.
Is it the volatility of crypto? Is it the fact that it can be hacked? What gives you pause when you think reserve and crypto together?
Yes and yes.
Okay. I
mean, we saw one of the biggest hacks in history 2 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
Bitbyte had a $1.4 billion hack of Ethereum, which disappeared to North Korea and is now spread out across the internet, unable to be retrieved. And that exchange had incredible security. Cold wallets, warm wallets, hot wallets, multi-signature level. But social engineering was used. You know, phishing, we get those crazy.
Yeah. Oh, we get tested all the time.
One person at that exchange opened one of those up, and it allowed what we'll call a Trojan horse or a worm to enter. And then patiently the hackers waited for that moment to seize, to go in. And when crypto was being moved from a cold wallet to a hot wallet, they swooped in and took it away.
Wow.
That's a concern for me.
Okay.
So then what are the, what's the benefit? Like, where on the optimist side of this, as far as like, this is a smart move for the country.
It's
what's
symbolic.
That argument?
It's symbolic.
Okay.
I mean, it has been stated that this shows our leadership as a country in digital assets, and that we would like entrepreneurs and digital asset firms to locate in the United States. So broadly speaking, the intention is to promote innovation and to show open for business in the United States when it comes to digital assets. In a way, it legitimizes digital assets.
Mm-hmm.
If the largest government in the world decides to hold these, it gives it some legitimacy.
Well, and we saw the market react to that, right? Because everything, all five of those digital assets went up after this announcement.
Yeah. Like Ryan said, volatility. I mean, went up spectacularly, dropped spectacularly, and it's back up. I mean, it's a yo-yo action.
Other than those digital companies who may relocate here, who else would benefit from this kind of move?
The crypto bros. The people that own the currency already. I mean, if I own cryptocurrency and there's only 21 billion Bitcoin that are ever going to be issued, I want the largest government in the world to buy several hundred thousand of these a year to push demand up. So who benefits? The existing holders.
But so this and this is, again, my little understanding about crypto. But I felt like, or I thought that one of the selling points of crypto was taking out the middleman of the government. That it was there was less intermediary meddling.
Decentralization.
Thank you. Yes. Yeah. And this seems like the government directly getting involved with it. And so isn't there some hypocrisy there as far as what there is?
I wrote a paper on that. Originally, Satoshi Nakamoto, whoever that was, the founder of Bitcoin, did this as a libertarian move to try to avoid centralized governments or banks from holding it. And so it is somewhat ironic that here we're looking at traditional finance and large governments investing in it. Yeah, it's ironic.
Okay.
Has there been any update on the Donald Trump meme coin and the rest of the Trump family's meme coins? We talked to you about that when it came out. Very exciting.
Ooh, ouch. Ouch. I'm not a fan of meme coins. You know that.
Right.
I mean, actually, I will say Dogecoin, surprisingly, is a great utility. And there are many musicians and artists and charitable organizations that are thankful for Dogecoin. It's an excellent transfer of funds.
Okay.
That's about the only meme coin that has any utility. The rest are truly jokes or memes, or worse, rug pulls, scams on the market. And so the Donald Trump meme coin was a complete surprise. He's at an inauguration celebration, pre-celebration on a Friday at 8 o'clock, and 500 million tokens were issued to family and friends, and then he posted that the Donald Trump meme coin was available. It shot up from basically a few dollars to over $70 within a couple of hours, and right now it's $13. There were 800,000 individual wallets, because we can track the online holders of this. Over 800,000 wallets have suffered a loss. So there were a few that made money. And
I was going to say, can you also track then how many people got rid of it right away as soon as it hit 70? How many people went, time to dump?
Yeah, we call those whales in the business. Those are very large holding insiders or promoters. And the whales know what they're doing. They use social media, influencers, and the like to drive up prices short term, called pump and dump. It's been done with penny stocks and real estate over the years. It was done here, got up to 70, and the whales exited.
And for now, that's legal.
Yeah. Is it ethical?
No, but as far as there, because there is no regulation on it yet, right?
That's correct. And that's where I am hopeful that we're going to move to some standardized regulations on this. Because right now, the enforcement has been after the fact. The previous administrations have regulated cryptocurrency by pulling you over and saying you were driving too fast, even though the speed limit was never posted.
Yeah.
At least here, we might now get some speed limits.
Who would be in charge of that, Congress or the SEC?
SEC.
Okay.
And would that come, do you think, if this all goes and the crypto reserve becomes a real thing, is that when the SEC steps in and tries to regulate a little more?
The SEC is working right now. They issued just the other day 50 questions for the public to respond to in the next 30 days. And then this crypto working group is going to get together and evaluate all the responses. They're going to roll up their sleeves. And within 90 days, they're going to propose the regulations. And the SEC is either going to adopt those or not.
So anyone in the public?
Yeah, sure.
Are you in the public?
I am in the public. I don't know what I would write. Where can you find this questionnaire?
Well, you can find it on the SEC site.
Okay.
The name of the commissioner is Heather Pierce. She's known as Crypto Mom.
Oh, God, okay.
That's her nickname. And she is heading up the SEC's side of the crypto task force.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Well, there you go. Go take a questionnaire if you have strong opinions about crypto. Yeah. David Krause, as always, thank you so much for joining us
and breaking it down.
Always a pleasure. All right. Thank you.
All right. We'll have more after this on Spanning the State.
It's Spanning the State. I'm Brian Noonan.
And I am Kristen Bry. I think when we were talking about crypto and meme coins, I'm pretty sure, so we were talking about the speech last night, and DJ Daniel, the young boy who survived brain cancer, is now the youngest Secret Service member. I'm pretty sure like someone started a meme coin for him last night.
Oh, of course.
Yes. You know, and so that is, I mean, but this is also to me sometimes the realization of like, some people just have too much money.
I guess.
I guess it's just like gambling though.
Or
I don't know if it's closer to gambling or if it's closer to investing in the stock market.
I would say it's closer to gambling because that is truly unknown. I mean, there's odds and all that kind of thing. The stock market at least is an established entity that
you can look at their reports and their profits.
It's all regulated. The other thing is just like, oh, I recognize that name. I'm going to throw some money down and see what happens.
Yeah. All
right. This is crazy.
ABC News and local headlines are next. Welcome back to Spanning the State. I am Kristen Bry.
And I'm Brian Noonan. Getting advice and support from someone with similar life experiences can sometimes be more effective than talking with other professionals. That's why we have mentors, right? Well, and that's the idea behind the Wisconsin Peer Specialist Employment Initiative, which is a service of Access to Independence. Part of the initiative is bringing that program to Wisconsin prisons, where over 100 incarcerated people in Wisconsin are now drawing on their personal experiences to mentor other prisoners. Here to tell us more about the initiative is Gaugi Vang. She's Peer Specialist Program Manager for Access to Independence. Gaugi, thanks for being here.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, can you explain the Peer Specialist Employment Initiative, and other than prisons, which we're going to get into, where is the program being utilized?
Yeah, so certified peer specialists can really be employed in various settings. You have certified peer specialists in inpatient settings, hospitals, jails, like you just brought up the Department of Corrections. We also have them at like peer recovery centers, peer-run respites, nonprofits, at the county level and at the state level. And certified peer specialists can, again, really do the work that they do in any of these spaces, as long as the agencies understand the role and the purpose of the role.
So what is the certification? Like certification training, what does that look like?
Yeah, so the training itself is 52 hours, and really this training focuses on a nonviolent communication skill. We call it the OR skill, so open-ended questions, affirmations, reflective listening, and summarizing. And so we really practice this communication skill throughout the training, as well as integrate different pillars to utilize. So such as like connecting with people, planning with people, really trying to figure out how to walk through a recovery journey with someone without the feeling like I have to tell you what to do. Because the purpose of a certified peer specialist is to walk alongside someone, not so much tell them what they need to do, not so much advising them on what they do. Because at the end of the day, sometimes we just need people to listen to us versus just having us like, hey, you need to do this or this or that.
Now, let's go back to something you said before. You said it works as long as the organizations understand the role of the program. What do the organizations have to understand?
Yeah, so it's really important to understand that certified peer specialists are not clinicians. The beauty of being a certified peer specialist is that you get to use your lived experience to guide others or support other people who are currently in their recovery journey. So they get the flexibility and the capacity to share their story. Whereas if you come from more of a clinical approach or through a clinical lens, you're kind of held to a liability perspective, a liability framework where you can't share anything about yourself, where it's really just about like, okay, the individual and what they need to do or what they are currently going through. And sometimes that works for people if that's what they're looking for. But other times, there's always like that feeling of like, hey, this person actually understands where I'm coming from. Or I know that this person has gone through recovery too. So because of that, I feel more comfortable connecting with them. Because of that, that initial connection and knowing that, people are more likely to open up to a certified peer specialist. They're more likely to trust a certified peer specialist because they see that this person is someone similar to them or has walked a similar life as them. And so that being said, we come from less of a clinical approach, whereas a lot of more mental health practitioners do come from a clinical liability framework. And that being said, it's really dependent on what people are looking for. If they're looking for someone to walk in this journey with them, I think a certified peer specialist is an excellent person to walk through with it. If they're looking for someone for like guidance, advice, mentoring, like kind of talking through what may be showing up for them, then maybe another clinician is a better fit for them.
That's what I was going to ask. And so as far as knowing kind of where a person is of what a successful peer relationship looks like and what you get out of it versus a therapist type situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what does that look like? Is that
when it works well, what are the benefits and like what do people get out of it that's maybe different than going to therapy?
Yeah, you get someone who advocates for you. You get someone who, again, the beauty of a certified peer specialist is you know that this person has had lived experience with mental health challenges and or substance use challenges. So that is a prerequisite of being a certified peer specialist is that you have to have that lived experience. We don't ask that you have to have a clinical diagnosis because the truth is that if we know we have anxiety or we have PTSD, that's something that we know, right? Like we are going through it. And so it's something that we don't always particularly need someone else to tell us. So we don't need that diagnosis, but you have to be at a point in your recovery journey where you feel like you can decenter yourself and come back to support someone else who's currently in the thick of their recovery. And so that being said, that part where they have that lived experience is the part that really connects people to a certified peer specialist because they know like, hey, I'm going through some substance use challenges and the certified peer specialist that I'm working with is someone who has had history with that. And because I know they have history with that, they know a little bit more. They can understand a little bit more of what I'm going through so that it feels a little less alone.
That makes perfect sense in every aspect of every organization that you might talk to. It especially seems relevant when it comes to inmates, like we were talking about. Now, I know you oversee the whole program, but you did host a webinar with the peer specialist coordinators for the DOC. What kind of feedback did you get from them, and what did you learn about the program's success or challenges from talking with the DOC?
Yeah, so it's been honestly such a privilege and an honor to be able to work with the Department of Corrections, especially with the folks within the carceral systems who are interested in becoming a certified peer specialist. So at our agency, we get to train people who are currently incarcerated. We get to train the trainers who will eventually go on to train more certified peer specialists in the Department of Corrections. And that has been one of the most humbling experiences for me because during this, one of the trainers in there has said to me, you know, it feels like freedom just being able to do this training because I don't get to learn very much outside of the four walls that he's in. But because he gets to be in this training, he gets to connect with people outside in the community. And then he gets to bring a little bit of that to where he is currently being serviced. So that has been really a really big impact for me personally. But then that being said, looking at the overall program in DOC, what we've heard and when we've connected with DOC was that when there's a certified peer specialist who is coming into a situation where maybe someone is currently going through a mental health crisis or they're really angry or frustrated, they're less likely, that situation is less likely to escalate when a certified peer specialist is involved because that certified peer specialist can come and connect with that individual without feeling like there's a power dynamic between them.
Sounds successful. Well, Gaughi, thank you so much for being here and explaining that. People can look up Access to Independence and find out more about all the projects there. Gaughi Vang is the Peer Specialist Program Manager for Access to Independence. Again, thanks, Gaughi. Have a great day.
No problem. Thank you.
All right. When we come back, decorum. What is it? Is it gone? Are we just living in a lawless time now where nobody has manners? We'll find out on Spanning the State.
R-E-S-P-E-C-T, find out what it means to me. R-E-S-P-E-C-T, take F-T-C-T.
There will be no respect at any sort of political gathering anymore. That is, listen, it's been evidence for a while. It was evidenced again last night where, you had Representative Al Green being shown the door because he heckled during
the speech.
He was
definitely heckling. I mean, there was more people than just him heckling at first.
Yes.
And then once he got kicked out, the rest of the Democrats just had their little
paddles.
Their little signs. I said this morning. It's so funny to me of, are we, because this is what British Parliament's like, right? Where it's
right.
You see the videos of things getting loud and there's booing and such, and that's kind of built into the fabric of that institution.
Did you see the video from Syria where they lit road flares and smoke bombs?
I did not
see
that.
Yesterday, or the day before. It was crazy. And I'm like, man, we're on our way. That's pretty good.
Yeah. And so I feel like, because this is not the first time, right?
No.
I always felt like the turning point was when the congressman yelled, "You lie,"
yes,
at Obama. But I was looking at USA Today on it. They tracked and have a graphic of the State of the Union and when heckling has been involved. And the first time that at least they say, and I don't know if this is actually historically accurate, because I feel like I've heard historical accounts of how crazy things were and how contentious things were in like the 1800s.
Oh, sure.
Especially over like slavery and,
yes,
and all the Civil War times. But they reference it back to two Democrats walking out during Gerald Ford's speech in 1975. And then there's like a couple instances. Nothing happens during the 80s. And then
okay,
in 1993, Republicans shout no at Bill Clinton over his health care plan.
Oh, okay. I remember that.
Democrats in 2005 booed at George Bush, mm-hmm, over Social Security. And then 2009, Representative Joe Wilson shouts liar.
And that
at
was,
Obama.
Remember how big a deal that was?
And then it feels like basically not every single one since, but it seems like there's more and more expectations that that's going to be one of the storylines out of what,
sure.
I called it something wrong. What was last night's speech actually called? Because it wasn't officially
stated. It was a joint session of Congress.
I called it a joint resolution at the top of the show. I was like, that's not right. What am I looking for?
Well, you go back. Nancy Pelosi tearing up Trump's State,
yep,
of the Union. Then Marjorie Taylor Greene and Lauren Boebert just shrieking like crazy people.
Banshees.
Banshees. Joe Biden.
At Joe Biden.
And now last night. But see, here's the I don't know. I used to think back when I was younger or even not too long in the past that at certain events you had to act a certain way because you don't want to rock the boat. You want to show proper respect. But now I'm at the point in my life where if I don't feel you have – nobody has earned that necessarily. You have to earn that. And if something is really, if I'm a congressperson, and I don't care, it just happens this time, it's the Democrats doing it to a Republican president. But we've seen it the other way, mm-hmm, too. Or Republicans do, yeah, Democrats doing it
they
to
do
a
it
Republican
to each other
president. Yeah. So, but my point is, if you're that against what is being said, and you truly feel that someone is not telling the truth, it's incumbent upon you to say something. And I think what Al Green did, the president said he had a mandate on this. Al Green said, no, you don't. And I'm paraphrasing, but then he said, I have a lot of people in my district who depend on Social Security and
Medicaid
for their health care. And then he was escorted out, and he was very calm when he talked to reporters out in the lobby. So I don't have a problem with it anymore. I remember being upset when Nancy Pelosi and I've never agreed with the current administration, even in their first go-round. But I was like, oh, come on, Nancy, you're the Speaker of the House. What are you doing?
Yeah,
tearing up the speech. Now I'm like, set that thing on fire if you don't want.
Well, the other thing to think about before we go to break is, you know, the Constitution requires providing an update to Congress. Could it not just be a YouTube video now? Like, do we have to do the pomp and circumstance? You know?
I think for the next 4 years, we have to, based on the fact that the president was very sad yesterday that no matter what he said, the Democrats were going to stand up and clap and smile and give him an ovation. So, yeah, we need the pomp and circumstance for the next few years.
All right. Well, we'll be back with more after this.